Hello and welcome to Oscar Baiting, an Academy Awards mini-series, entirely in your free feed, brought to you by me, Evan, at McDonald Tweets, host of the Kino Lefter podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I was waffling on what the name of this series would be, and then listening back on it, I thought this would be funny. So the idea for this series, which may not have been fully explicated in the actual episode, is that in the weeks leading up to the upcoming Academy Awards, I will have on a rotating panel of friends to talk about the good films and the bad films that we've seen so far this year. So this episode's really fun. You'll hear what the films are if you haven't already seen them in the title soon. Good selections, I think. And also, in the episode, I talk about how I'm going to release a little teaser for the next Patreon series. Well, guess what, folks? This is the teaser right here. It's not going to be a separate episode in your feed. So I am proud to announce that I am embarking on a 9-episode miniseries entirely in the Patreon feed. So it will not interrupt your regularly scheduled programming. And it's called Takes from the Forbidden Zone, a miniseries on Planet of the Apes. So this is the big reveal. People have been wondering, what's the next series going to be? Because we did Gun Barrel. I think people really responded to Gun Barrel in a very positive way. So people have been asking what the next series will be that gets this sort of treatment. And I can confirm for you today, it's going to be Planet of the Apes. So the next episode in your Patreon feed is not going to be the first episode of this series, but in fact, next week's Patreon episode will be on the 1968 Planet of the Apes film. I think that the schedule I'm going to go with for this series is probably going to be bi-weekly. At the very least, I don't want it to be every single episode in a row, just Planet of the Apes stuff, as much as I might enjoy that. But that could get old pretty soon. I do want to still cover new films in the Patreon feed. So this might take a little while to fully realize, because of course there are 9 films. And yes, my vision for this series is to go from the 1968 Planet of the Apes film to 2017's War for the Planet of the Apes. So, congratulations, listener. You now know what the next Patreon series will be. So, that's the teaser. I'm very excited for it. Have a great set of guests lined up for Takes from the Forbidden Zone. So if you're interested in that, you can head over to patreon.com/kinolefter, and for 3 beautiful US dollars a month, you can get access to that whole series. The reason it's going to be Patreon only as opposed to some episodes in the free feed, some episodes in the Patreon feed, this way you can opt in to get the whole experience. I think that's a definite plus of it. And I'm still free to do sort of the main shtick of the show in the free feed, covering newly released films from the quirky, off-kilter perspective that Kino Lefter has always promised to deliver you. So, let's get on with the show. Welcome to the first episode in a Oscar Fever miniseries. I'm not certain what the title will be yet. It will probably just be Oscar Fever, but I certainly have Oscar Fever. I'm excited about all the films of the Academy Awards this year. Really, the best movies that are being released can be seen at the Academy Awards, and we watched 2 of them. This week, I am joined by podcaster, writer, educator, and host/co-host of Coffee with Comrades and Macabre Media. It's Pearson Bolt. Pearson, welcome back to the show.
Hey, buddy. How you doing? It's so good to be back with you and hang out. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate you putting this together. I'm glad that I get to be the first victim on the Oscar Fever podcast series. Hey, I gotta ask you, aren't the Oscars supposed to happen in February? Did something happen? Because clearly I haven't been paying attention.
Yeah, I think they were delayed because of the insidious illness known as COVID-19.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so they're just pushed back so far that, like, it doesn't feel like, obviously I don't think the Oscars have been, like, culturally important for a while, besides for when they, like, fuck up and not give Moonlight an Oscar or something. That's when people talk about them.
Or last year when Parasite, like, won Best Picture and all of the reactionary trolls on Twitter like had a fucking conniption.
Yeah, like, of course there have been like a myriad of scandals that the Oscars are involved in, you know, like Oscars So White a few years ago, and people have been using it as a platform to talk about, you know, the abuses of Hollywood. But this year, like, there are just a lot of stinky movies that got nominated.
A lot of stinky movies, dude. Like, yeah. And we're going to talk about one of them today. We're going to talk about one that was straight doo-doo ass. It was not good.
Yeah, like, in putting these episodes together, like, I made a list of the Oscar-nominated films that have not been covered so far on the show. So if you're like, where's the episode on Nomadland? Where's the episode on Judas and the Black Messiah? Those episodes are already in the feed, folks. We've already talked about them. But this is like, you know, the refuse. What's left?
This is the trash. This is the detritus that's been thrown away.
Yeah. So we did a double feature this week, and all of these episodes in the main feed leading up to our good friend Oscar will be double features. Some of these films are very good. Some of these are very bad. And I think this is a great sort of capturing of the duality of the Oscars this year. So we watched Aaron Sorkin's Trial of the Chicago 7 and also the Mads Mikkelsen starring comedy drama Another Round.
Very different movies. Just totally, totally different.
Yeah, like I watched Trial of the Chicago 7 a while ago. I had it on again today while I was just doing stuff around the house, and I would just be so dispirited at, like, certain lines or scenes that I just hated so much, and it just, like, sapped so much energy from me. And I watched Another Round last night, and I remember at the end of that film, I think I did actually stand up because I was so happy. Because that film has an incredible ending, which we'll get to sort of later on in the show. But we're going to talk about Trial of the Chicago 7 first. This is Aaron Sorkin wrote this and he directed it. And he wrote.
So you know that it's going to be bad. That's how you know.
He wanted to do everything for this film because I think he's been working on this script since 2006. And he was originally pitching it to Steven Spielberg as the director. And there were a bunch of other directors who were sort of attached to do this movie. And then I think Spielberg was going to produce it. And then he was like, Aaron, you've got to do this movie. Because Aaron Sorkin, he's also directed Molly's Game from a few years ago. Don't know if you've seen Molly's Game.
I have. Yeah. I have.
I thought it was okay. I didn't hate middling. Molly's Game. Yeah.
I went and saw it with my parents in the theaters. They loved it.
Oh, that's a parent movie. Molly's Game is absolutely a parent movie.
Yeah, dude, that's what I'm saying, bro. You beat me to it. That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, I feel like their generation would definitely fuck with that movie where I was just like, meh.
Yeah. And this movie, I would also say parents around the world will celebrate Trial of the Chicago 7. They will stand up and cheer at the end of this film, and also pay respect to America's Fallen, respectfully, at the end
respectfully.
Of the film.
Respectfully. That's very important. It's got to be respectfully. Yeah. Paying my respects, sir.
Oh, my God,
bro.
But, yeah, so Aaron Sorkin, he really did it this time. So this film is about, obviously, the trial of the Chicago 7 following the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Very contentious, obviously. A lot of anti-war movement protesters were in the city trying to speak about the nomination of Hubert Humphrey, who, you know, not the most radical candidate in Democratic Party history. And this film has quite a cast. I mean, that's something we can talk about a lot. But you get your Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Sacha Baron Cohen's. You get your Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Michael Keaton is also in this. Eddie Redmayne, Mark Rylance. And this film is currently nominated for 6 Academy Awards. So
Six.
So it's nominated for Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Original Song, and Best Film Editing. So especially the Best Picture nomination was one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it. But having watched it kind of twice now, like, the cinematography, this movie looks like ass.
Dude, it's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible. It's awful. How did it get nominated for the cinematography? It's like you gave a sixth grader a picture, and then you gave him a pair of scissors, and you said, make a puzzle out of this. And then he tried to piece it back together after cutting it into a million little pieces. That's how this, it's very choppy. It's very disjointed. And like, at first I was like, oh, okay, so we're going to do some kind of like nonlinear thing here where we're going to jump backwards and forwards in time. And then it didn't really do that. It didn't really commit to that. Mm-hmm. I think is fair to say. Like, yeah. I think if it had leaned into that harder, it might have been better. But it felt like you were having your hand held and a book read to you at the same time. It felt like I was sitting on Aaron Sorkin's lap and he had this like, you know, beautiful like picture book sitting out in front of us, and he was like flipping the page because there's like these really like ham-fisted moments where Richard Schultz, who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's the prosecutor in the case, will be trying to recall what one of the defendants said, and then it cuts back in time to the defendant actually saying the thing, and it just feels so forced. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I thought it was very funny because I was watching some reviews of Trial of the Chicago 7, and a lot of them are very fawning. To be fair, there are reviewers who did not enjoy this film very much, but most of the reception has been very positive. But someone compared its structure to Rashomon, in that like it's cutting between these different perspectives of what happened, and it really doesn't. It like cuts to different perspective characters. We don't really get into like their psyche or like how events might change based on how they're viewed, but I thought the structure was okay in that it presented a largely like entertaining sort of piece. Like, it hit sort of, you know, emotional highs and lows, regardless of whether they're like historically accurate or, you know, great. The writing is grating. But it doesn't really commit, as you were saying, to a sort of structure that weaves in and out of time, because there's one framing device of Sacha Baron Cohen's character, Abby Hoffman, giving one of these like campus talks, which he actually did to raise money during the trial and afterwards, recounting events, but he's really only cut to a couple of times, and the dialogue is so, like, I use the word grating a lot, but there were two particular moments, I think, that I just, all of the air left my body, that I was so upset. And one of them was when Abby Hoffman said, "And this part of the trial is what I call with friends like these," and then it cuts back to the trial, and I just, like, why did this happen in a film? Like, this isn't Batman Begins, you know, this isn't Rashomon. Like, the flashback structure isn't telling us anything important about the characters or this story. It is just like, let's be clever. It is Aaron Sorkin being like, and now there's characters who are going to say the same sentence 3 times in a row, and they're in different places, and then the music is like, you know, the drums are getting faster, so then an audience member's like, wow, what really did happen? Did the activists start the riots, or did the cops? Which is the central question of this movie, which is so unbearably stupid. Whether
no, it really is.
Protesters or the Chicago police started the riots. And this is like the central tension of the story. And of course it's divorced from any of the politics of these people or like why they came to Chicago. Like the film is
mostly concerned
with that.
Yeah, there's like vague anti-war sentiment. Like that's it. There's no like thoughtful critique of the democratic process. There's certainly no like actual socialism, and anything that actually is in the film is played up for laughs, right? Yeah. Like the reduction of the hippies to a bunch of, or the yippies to a bunch of like weed smoking hippies, right? The framing of the SDS as entitled rich brats who just want to spit in the face of their parents, right? Yeah. And like, say what you will about the politics of the yippies and the SDS, those caricatures are absolutely not accurate. You know what I mean? Like, and so it just, it reeks to me of the sort of liberal self-righteousness that is, I can't say that I've watched Aaron Sorkin's work extensively, but I understand is part and parcel of sort of what he does, right? He's the guy who did The West Wing, right?
Yes, he is. He is, yeah, so Mr. West Wing himself.
It's the liberal like fantasy, right? That, you know, a couple people who have, you know, thoughtful, rational logic can engage and have an argument and the best argument will come out and win, right? Like that's sort of how people like Aaron Sorkin view the world. It's not surprising that there's these really reductive caricatures of the politics of the characters. I went into it expecting that. But what's interesting to me about it is that Sorkin, or at least the filmmakers in general, are particularly adept at the aesthetics and the visual cues of radical politics, which I think is very fascinating because it reduces it, right, not only to caricature, not only to jokes, but it does reduce it to aesthetics. And the aestheticization of politics is something that I think is really dangerous, especially if you study the aestheticization of politics, you know that it's like one of the leading contributors of like fascism. Mm-hmm. And so it speaks to me that this film in this particular moment has the auspices of trying to say something interesting or important, but really only exacerbating the very tensions that it's coming out of. Does that kind of make sense?
It does make sense. And I think that one strong contributor to that effect that the film has is that I was watching some behind the scenes stuff, and Sorkin's stated goal with the film is, of course, I'm not making a film about 1968. I'm making a film about today. So that's why these characters can be molded and changed from who they originally were, because especially one of the characters I was most familiar with was Tom Hayden and sort of the SDS and the Port Huron Statement. Like, especially the Port Huron Statement, like, I think it's very informative for people on the left to read it. And obviously, I think there's a lot of great stuff in there. I think it's also fairly dated. And, you know, it's an interesting vision of the left trying to navigate a changing power structure where they thought, okay, we can build up this sort of power within, you know, universities, for example, as opposed to, you know, a broader working class or a sort of, you know, unionized working class. And then you can talk about, the division between the Weather Underground and SDS. And I feel like to simplify those sorts of political differences into, the SDS are conservatives now. Like, they believe in, respecting the institutions, respecting authority. They believe in dressing correctly. And everyone is so concerned with the optics of politics in this film. Because there's
so concerned.
There's one key conversation that Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden have where it's basically about respectability politics, where Tom Hayden's talking about, you know, in 50 years, i.e. when you're watching this movie, when people think about progressive politics, they're just going to think about the yippies and, you know, the unwashed masses and everything. I'm cool. You know, I'm focused on the real revolution. And it's such a muddled, confused image of these actual people, right? And I think that was one tension I had in the film, because the first viewing, I just wanted to watch it, like, as a film product, and I really didn't like it. And then on the second viewing, I was like, okay, like, I know who these people are. I want to maybe take more time to focus on, like, is this, like, a real reflection of who these people are? And no, obviously it's completely distorted because Sorkin is very focused on the emotional truth of this story, which I think is even bungled in this, because, like, the message I think that Sorkin is kind of advocating for at the end here is a very Sorkin-esque thing, where through the power of intellect and persistence, you can defeat the bad actors within an otherwise good system. And what happens, the trial of the Chicago 7 is not an exemplar of that kind of thinking, right?
No, absolutely not.
It was a complete circus. You know, it was an attempt by the Nixon administration to punish its enemies very quickly, you know, within his tenure. And, you know, it was a national media sensation. There were weird celebrities who came in as star witnesses. It was, you know, it was an absolute farce. And I don't know if it's, you know, obviously the 1968 Democratic Convention is sort of an important flashpoint moment in 20th century left American politics. And you wouldn't get it from this. So it's very sad.
I mean, it's also the point that he chooses, right, to focus on the trial, right? It's not about the Democratic National Convention and all of the organizing, all of the protesting, all of the coalition building that went into pulling off something like that, and then the subsequent, like, crackdown from the police. Instead, right, it's a movie about the aftermath. And again, I think that this is a really calculated choice where Sorkin and the filmmakers are deciding the grounds upon which we are to understand this critical history, right? It's supposed to be viewed through the lens and the language of the law and the courtroom. And again, it sort of speaks to this idea, right, that you just hinted at, that even though there's a few bad actors, right, the system itself is inherently good. But the history does not show that in any way, shape, or form. And so it's like you would think that this motherfucker would either, like, pause, right, for some critical self-evaluation after working on this movie in some form or another for 15 fucking years. But instead, it's just like, nope, just full speed ahead. You know what it is, Evan? It's like when my students, right, have a thesis in mind, and then they go out and they perform research, and then the research that they do contradicts that thesis that they initially had, and then they don't change the thesis, even though they have all this evidence in their paper that directly contradicts the argument that they're trying to make. And I'm just like, how, like, do you not think? Like, how do you have this cognitive dissonance in your brain when it's so patently obvious that the argument that you're trying to make, at least in this particular instance, is incorrect? And I would say that it's incorrect in every instance, that the law, of course, is an instrument used primarily, if not only, to bludgeon the poor and to allow for the ruling class to continue to perpetuate its wealth. But, like, it's just like, bro, like, how do you make this movie and miss, like, my partner Megan and I sat for like a good 30 minutes after the movie was over and just were like looking back and forth at each other and like, how do you make this movie know this history? Because clearly, like, it's clear that he knows the history, right? Yeah. Like, he knows what happened at the Democratic National Convention. He knows what happened at the trial that happened subsequently thereafter. He knows about the sort of details of the backroom meetings between the power players and power brokers. But he fails, right, to make that incisive point, right, that the law is a tool to ameliorate the anger of the proletariat, and to essentially funnel more and more and more power towards the police state, more and more power towards the wealthy and more power to the ruling class. And so it's funny, right, that this movie misses the mark so obviously. I don't know. It's baffling to me.
I think one particular instance of how Sorkinizes the events and characters, thereby, you know, stripping away any sort of radical politics they would have. There's two instances that came to mind. I was reading through the Slate article, and they were sort of highlighting the, you know, fact versus fiction in this movie. And there was a couple scenes that troubled me for, you know, partially ideological reasons and some other ones. But there's a sequence in a park where there's this woman who's being attacked by some like frat guys, and theoretically there was a fight over an American flag that was part of it, and apparently there is some testimony it's because the protesters replaced an American flag with I mean, it's just called a communist flag here, but the Stars and Stripes, not the only banner that was there. You know, that's all that Sorkin is really interested in this context. And then there was also, the ending of the film, I will be, you know, sort of jumping around the plot because it is all very bad. But Tom Hayden uses his closing remarks as a moment to read a list of names of American soldiers who were killed in the Vietnam War. And with the only exception of one quick line at the beginning of the film from this SDS presentation, the anti-war sentiment of these characters only comes from, you know, Americans are being sent to these countries to kill people, right? It's not, you know, war is this imperialist tool, or there are, you know, millions of South Asian people who are being killed. It's mostly they're concerned about Americans.
Oh, totally. They only talk about American death. Like, right. Like the, when he's doing this whole, you know, political stunt, he's only reading the deaths of American soldiers killed in battle. Only the imperialists who are going overseas to, you know, to kill people and to try and stop communism, right? And so it's really telling that the framing of imperialism is reduced to violence versus nonviolence, because we get some Martin Luther King at the very, very beginning of the film. And one of the characters, I believe, David Dellinger, was like a committed pacifist, right? Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Like, you know, like that's a conversation that we can have about, you know, committed pacifism or, you know, commitments to nonviolent resistance. I used to be a huge proponent and practitioner of nonviolence. I've since recanted the error of my ways. No, but it is interesting, right, that the framing is violence versus nonviolence, war versus peace, instead of imperialism versus socialism, or revolutionary struggle versus the liberal status quo, right? And I think that, again, these are deliberate obfuscations, because Aaron Sorkin, And I could be wrong. Maybe he's just a stupendous, you know, gigantic idiot. But I have a very difficult time believing that. You know what I mean? Like, again, as you said, he's been working on this film since, what, 2006? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to me to think that during the research and production of this film that he didn't read the writings of these people, that he didn't come across their politics, and he doesn't understand them. He might disagree with them, and that's fine, because I disagree with many of the principles of the SDS and many of the principles of the Yippies, but he just pushes them aside. And I think that's partially because of the fact that he is intentionally designing this movie as Oscar bait. Like, it's intentionally meant to be to whet the appetites of the Oscars, and to try to drum up, you know, be this like political moment, which I think it, again, speaks to the aestheticization of politics, because that moment, and I'm glad you brought it up, Evan, that moment where the two like reactionaries, they call them frat bros. That's not,
yeah,
not frat bros. They're fucking reactionaries. Mm-hmm. Like that's what they are. You know, they are conservative far right reactionaries who not only like try to steal the flag back from this girl who's on the shoulders of another person, but they also try to like sexually assault her. Right. And again, there's the flag is used to cover her up after her like bodice has been ripped off. Like they use the flag to cover her up. And it's like the implicit symbolism there is that the red, white, blue is going to protect you no matter what. You know, it's going to protect you if you're getting assaulted by a bunch of reactionary chuds. But like the reality, of course, is that that's precisely the sort of thing that was happening in Vietnam, right? That these were precisely the types of war crimes that were being perpetuated against people in Vietnam during this period. And so it's such a lazy erasure, but I think it's one that's done intentionally, because I think that it would be impossible for Aaron Sorkin to make this movie without having to confront his politics and his own politics in some way, shape, or form. And it reeks to me of this intentional, deliberate caricaturizing of the left in order to not actually have to think critically about his own politics and his own positions. Does that kind of make sense?
I think it does. And importantly, the sequence that you were describing, the sort of attack that woman suffered, there's no record of it. It seems to be a creation of the film. And I mean, the ending of the film, which we can get into, really sort of establishes the ideological framework of the film. But I think what you were saying about how Aaron Sorkin, you know, whether he has to confront his own politics or not, it's very funny because, of course, he's making the film about today, and he's making the film about Donald Trump and resisting Donald Trump and being a sort of liberal without a clear home who needs to, you know, what are my values? What are these American values that I hold dear through the lens of, like, you know, the radical left in the late 1960s? So, mm-hmm. like, all of their viewpoints are just reduced to, I always thought this was like the easy criticism of Aaron Sorkin, because again, I hadn't seen much of Sorkin's work where it's just like, oh, you know, like, you know, liberals can be patriots too. Like that's a lot of the politics of the West Wing. And that just becomes the politics of this, where, yeah, you know, totally. Abbie Hoffman is like, I love Tom Hayden because he's a badass American patriot. And, you know, America's
cool.
He
literally said that. I cringed. There's no way in hell that Abbie Hoffman would have ever said that. Mm-hmm. It's just ludicrous.
Yeah. And I think it's another Abbie Hoffman line. I tried to write it down where he was talking about, you know, I think the institutions of our democracy are great things, but it's the people who occupy them right now who are terrible. And totally. That's supposed to be like a really like morally clarifying statement. And especially the end of the film, of course, that didn't happen in real life. So Tom Hayden doesn't list off, you know, American war dead and then everyone clapped. This is very much in the genre of and then everyone clapped movies. There was an event in the trial that was similar to that, where importantly, the defendants were listing off the names of American war dead and people that the United States had killed in Vietnam. And then they brought in a North Vietnamese banner into the courtroom. And then the marshals were like trying to wrestle it from them. So, you know, that doesn't happen in the film, right? It is just troop worship, to the point where it's the funniest line in the film. We sort of alluded to it at the beginning, where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is, you know, standing in solidarity with these, you know, communists and anarchists and, you know, everything else who are reading off, you know, dead American boys who were sent over to Vietnam. And then he says, you know, sir, it's respect for the fallen. So it was just like, it's astonishing. It's astonishing to the, like, There are children standing up. There are moms clapping in the courtroom. It's just like, you know, it's just the biggest slice of cheese you could ever watch. and like realizing that Sorkin is making this about today, this is like, you know, the impeachment trial gone right for Donald Trump, right? Like this is, you know, the smart people with tenacity and the right politics have been able to really stick it to the people in power, the nasty people who are in power, who, you know, are not political subjects of a unjust system. They are just bad people with bad motives, and we need to replace them. And even Abbie Hoffman, I thought this was going to be contradicted or something, or like proven to be something he just said in the trial. But he talks about how Abraham Lincoln has this quote about, you know, revolutionary activity against your own government if it's unconstitutional. And then Abbie Hoffman says, and we do it every 4 years. It's called voting. So, you know, all they wanted to do was register people to vote. That I thought that was really interesting. That's what left politics is about. It's about voting for the right people. And that's a big thing that I learned watching this film.
It's just, it's so obvious too that Abbie Hoffman is reduced to being a mouthpiece for Aaron Sorkin, right? Like it is Aaron Sorkin speaking through this caricaturized version of Abbie Hoffman, whether it's like, this is a political trial, cultural revolution, you know, like talking about art and, you know, yelling about how the SDS doesn't have any actual moral values. And like, you know, it's very much Aaron Sorkin speaking through Abbie Hoffman. And I think the quintessential moment is the one that you just brought up where he's like, yeah, we overthrow the government every 4 years in this country because we vote. Like, and that was supposed to be like a mic drop moment. And I can just imagine just like the crickets like chirping at that in the moments after that. It's just, I don't know, Evan, this, I kind of hate you for making me watch this movie. It was exhausting.
I needed our top minds on it, you know? So I'm sorry that I put you through the ringer of this film.
Oh man, it's all good. We can talk about a good one though. That's the upside.
Well, other things I wanted to touch upon briefly for Trial of the Chicago Seven. I think it's very interesting that that Mr. Sorkin makes a point of trying to argue that radical white women are only driven by their sexual impulses, and that's why they join leftist movements. Of course, because there's a woman operating the phones at the house that the defendants are staying at. And
the conspiracy office.
The conspiracy office. And she's talking about, you know, having sex with black men. And you know,
yeah,
that's,
it was so racist and
yeah,
gross.
That's what's implied to be on the phone call. And, you know, it's treated as a joke, but it's, she's also being serious, and it's the racial politics of this film are obviously very questionable because the Black Panthers play a large role in it. And listeners of the show will know we talked about Judas and the Black Messiah a while ago, which I think is a better representation of the Black Panthers and their politics. I mean, we're looking towards Hollywood movies for, you know, honest representations of the Black Panthers. You know, they will be found wanting. But this one really in particular was not good. And I think, like, Fred Hampton is in this film, which was a surprise to me. You know, I wasn't familiar with every aspect of, you know, this trial before watching the film. And while it is true that Fred Hampton, you know, was there to support Bobby Seale, who, of course, co-founded the Black Panthers with Huey Newton, but his dialogue is treated like he's treated kind of as a joke through a lot of the film, because he's talking about, look at all these white people sitting here while my black friend is in a cell. And then he sort of like, you know, their defense lawyer like beats him intellectually. And then he's like, oh, okay. And then, of course, like Fred Hampton is assassinated. And then, you know, that's, you know, it's a big deal within the film. It's treated very poorly, I would say, visually. I don't know if you've seen Judas and the Black Messiah.
I haven't seen it yet.
But you don't see Fred Hampton's body in that film. I think the assassination scene is handled, like, with taste. And there are just photos of his body being dragged out of his apartment in this film. And I thought that was pretty nasty that the movie did that. And a movie about sort of anti-war protesters. You know, there's no sort of sense of the horror that they're protesting, right? But the no. one sort of like brutal death that they choose to highlight is Fred Hampton's, and that felt pretty out of whack.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, and then they had that whole scene with Bobby Seale where they like cut again this piece of the cinematography thing where they're cutting back and forth between him getting like shackled and bound and gagged in a chair by the marshals while the rest of the court just waits, you know, in suspense. That scene was just like, bro, what are you trying to do here? And then like did that actually lead to a mistrial?
Yes. So Bobby Seale did get a mistrial out of this because he was actually gagged in court. Not because of the assassination of Fred Hampton, which because the events don't really happen that way in real life. I was reading about this and it's interesting. Bobby Seale was gagged because he called the judge a fascist and a racist pig.
Nice.
And there were like these pictures of like some of like the founding fathers or something behind the judge, and he's like, you know, those were slave owners and everything else. And you know, that's when he got gagged. And I think after that, Fred Hampton was killed. But nice. And then eventually Bobby Seale was separated from that trial and then became a famous cooking television host later on in his life. So good for you, Bobby Seale. I know Bobby Seale's also been trying to get sort of his version of events of this trial turned into a film, and he's been unsuccessful at that. So congratulations to Aaron Sorkin for bringing this story to filmic life.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't ask for a worse filmmaker to put this together. Like I'm hard pressed. Like maybe Zack Snyder, because he would have like, you know, shot the whole thing and like it would have focused way more on the police brutality than necessary. But there would have been like slow mos of like the brutality of the police beating people. But I jokes aside, I am hard pressed to think of like a worse director to do this.
Yeah, and I think even Snyder or someone like Michael Bay, they're very much like visual stylists, right? Like they would be like, what are the coolest looking moments of this? I'm gonna do that. But Aaron Sorkin needs to prove an ideological point. So I think that fundamental poison of like, and especially with films having the ideological power they have because so many people watch them, this will be like the canonized version of these events until someone, you know, has what they saw challenged by someone and then they bother to look it up. But for the most part, I don't think that's going to happen. And by all accounts, most people sort of, you know, enjoy this as like popcorn flair. And, you know, it has a pretty sinister message about the purpose of politics, especially radical politics, and, you know, sort of tracing a lineage for Aaron Sorkin himself. Like, oh, these guys, I'm cool like them. I'm also anti-war now. You know, that's Aaron. That's our Aaron. So Aaron Sorkin, kudos to you, sir. Salute from the Kino Lefter studio. I have a feeling that this is going to win Best Picture. There are much better films nominated for Best Picture, but I have a bad feeling that this is going to emerge from the pack and win. Because I'm thinking about Academy voters, you know, older white people, particularly older white men. I feel like this kind of speaks to them, right? And I think that this ultimately captures a difficult, complex period of history and wraps it up into a very simple institutional liberal narrative that, you know, soothes real divides and doesn't make us ask any questions. So I feel like this is Oscar bait. This is the point of making a movie to win these kinds of awards.
Yeah. No. I hope sincerely that you're proven wrong and that this film becomes a relic in the dustbin of cinematic tripe that is called Oscar bait. But in the event that you are correct, I will mourn. A part of my soul will die.
Oh, unfortunately. However, there is another film that we watched this week that we have a chance to talk about now. And of course, that is Thomas Vinterberg's Another Round. And I think the original Danish title for the film is Druk. Nice. I'm pretty sure that means drunk or drink or something like that. What a phenomenal film. And I'll give sort of a high-level overview of the plot. There are four high school teachers who have become enlightened to this psychological thesis that the human body is born at too low a blood alcohol level, so they are going to maintain a constant buzz of 0.05% throughout the day in order to succeed socially and professionally. And it stars Mads Mikkelsen, and he's one of the best actors. He's just an extraordinary man. You know, hot off the heels of his success in Hideo Kojima's Death Stranding. That was the last thing that I saw him in, and he was great in that. And he's back. Mads is back, and I'm Mads about Mads. What'd you think about this movie, Pearson?
Oh, man. I, too, am Mads about Mads. This movie, it put me through, I wouldn't say, an emotional ringer, but I definitely I was laughing at times. I was sad at times. I was melancholic at times. I was euphoric at times. It's a very dense movie. And it feels like a movie that rewards subsequent viewings. And the first time that I watched it was this morning in preparation for this conversation. So I haven't had a chance to go back and watch it, but one of these days I doubtlessly will, because I did sincerely enjoy it. I think that the movie is at its best in the quiet moments where there's not a shit ton of things happening. And it's just the four buddies, the four drinking buddies, having funny conversations and being weird. They're just, all these people are weird. Also, I love Specs. Specs is the best character in this whole fucking movie. I will die for Specs. Specs is incredible.
Do you want to explain who Specs is?
Okay, so Specs is the little child. He's like this scrawny little runt of a human being. And he wears bispectacles. And so Tommy, one of Mads Mikkelsen's characters, Martin, one of Martin's drinking buddies, is a coach part-time. He's a gym teacher at their high school, but he's also a coach part-time for little kids. And he and Specs develop a very beautiful, healthy, father-son kind of relationship. There's this really tender moment where Specs reaches up and holds Tommy's hand. And then of course, Tommy dies from we're not entirely sure, probably a boating accident, maybe suicide. It's hard to say for sure. Tommy dies and Specs is at his funeral, and it's just that moment was so tough.
I was very excited for this film. I think because my big introduction of Mads Mikkelsen was Casino Royale. And then I spent quite a long time watching him on Hannibal, which, is one of my favorite television shows ever.
I've never watched it. Is it good?
It's so good. He plays Hannibal Lecter, of course.
Right.
And it's all about his relationship with Will Graham, FBI profiler, whom he is the psychiatrist of. And it's a fantastic cat and mouse show. It's brilliantly shot. It's excellently written. And their relationship is sort of the center of the film. And seeing him in this, I sincerely think it's a huge achievement of acting, because especially for I'm upset a little bit that he wasn't nominated for Best Actor. Because I think that acting...
What is this movie, if I might interrupt? What is it?
Great point. So it's nominated for two Academy Awards. It's nominated for International Feature Film and Best Director. So I think it's definitely worthy of both of those without seeing all the other candidates right now. But I think that Mads Mikkelsen's acting is one of like the strongest elements of this film. And I think that it's a continual phenomenon of actors in non-English speaking roles not being nominated for like acting awards. I think that's just like a pretty common occurrence. But he's tremendous in this. And I think that especially in the beginning, sort of just like the quiet sadness of his life was so mm-hmm. gripping. And I don't know, as an educator, how much you want to speak to this, but I felt like it was fairly universal. But, you know, he's getting older and he's sort of lost like the joy and confidence of his life that he used to have. And just like being in front of a classroom of high schoolers and, you know, well, not doing your best for them, but also just not getting anything out of it anymore. It was just so like depressing.
Yeah, no, it was really depressing. And I think it struck close to home for me, for a number of reasons. One, because my dad's an alcoholic. He's a recovering alcoholic, I should say, but he's an alcoholic. And then also because like Mads Mikkelsen's character and all of the main characters in this film, the four drinking buddies are all teachers. And so like after now, God, it's been over a year now of doing teaching exclusively on Zoom. Oh my God. That's like literally like one of the most paralyzing kind of like fears that I have is that like, because I love teaching. I really enjoy it. It's something that brings me a lot of like pleasure and joy and intellectual like stimulation is having conversations with students and like thinking about pedagogy, thinking about how to teach and how to teach well and how to do it, but also recognizing that like teaching is a performance and it's fucking exhausting, especially as like a very introverted person. And so like the notion of having to get to a point in like a career, which I hate like calling teaching a career because it just seems weird, but like getting to the point in my tenure of teaching where I don't enjoy it anymore is like terrifying to me. Like that's something that like legitimately scares me, and I've caught flashes of it teaching on Zoom, because teaching on Zoom is like, Evan, let me tell you, dude, it's like pulling teeth. It's like I stare most of my students, and for perfectly understandable reasons, don't want to turn their camera on, which I get, you know, but like it's awful. Like I can't have a conversation with them, I can't communicate with them, we can't dialogue. There's no rich, stimulating interaction. It's all me talking at them, which frankly sucks ass and can't be enjoyable for them and certainly isn't enjoyable for me. But there is that like give and take, right? There's only so much that I can do and there's only so much that they can do. And I understand that like if I had to take classes right now, I would be fucking miserable. Like I would not turn on my camera. I would not pay attention. I would be browsing the internet. I would just like log into Zoom and just fuck around. So like, I get it. I really do. But it's interesting thinking about how that movement can get you to a point where year after year after year of teaching the same thing, it becomes dull, boring, and stale and not fun anymore. So yeah, that hit me in the feels, my guy. And it's funny too, because like, you know, this movie on its surface is like four dudes go through a midlife crisis and they're going to drink a lot and it's going to be funny. But like this movie has so much heart and it has so much that it's trying to say about like the human condition and about our interpersonal relationships and about like, about masculinity and about like brotherhood. I thought that was like really, really powerful. And like the best part about it is that it doesn't throw it in your face. Like fucking Chicago, Trial of the Chicago 7. Like this movie is very, very, very subtle and it just presents its characters and its themes to you and allows you to just kind of live in their world for like 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate what you said there. And I think even as someone who's, you know, not an educator, but in like, you know, certain contexts, I've taught like, you know, a tutorial or a workshop or something like that. And you see those sorts of moments of like real catharsis or like breaking through these barriers in life. And, you know, even if you're not an educator, I think you're going to appreciate this movie. Like, once they start the experiment, which they are, you know, writing a paper on, which is hilarious. Which is, I don't so think this funny, got ethics dude. Approval, but they're writing a paper on it. Like the first sequence where, well, it's interesting because the film sort of like, it feels very real in how it portrays sort of like, you know, substance abuse and like the highs and lows of it. I know you're talking about your dad and like, you know, my dad, you know, he's been dead for too long for him to be an alcoholic right now. But obviously alcoholism, being from a, you know, poor maritime family, it's a common factor among my family. And especially with like people thinking about one person in particular, my stepdad, whom I hate, you know, no longer my stepdad. But when he drank, that was when, you know, you sort of see this like hyperactivity or like trying to be like more social and like, you know, trying to be like friendly and everything else, like bringing out these like gregarious aspects of someone's personality. Because as the movie identifies, like Mads Mikkelsen feels like he's lost his confidence, and through drinking more, he's going to be able to get it back. Which I was worried for a little while in the film. I was like, oh my God, is the movie's thesis going to be you have to drink more in order to be happy? Which it doesn't ultimately, you know, position itself as. I was worried it would. But I think it's really great how the first instance of him coming back to school to teach, when he's drunk, he can barely get through his lesson. Like, he's stumbling over his words and he's very confused. And it's like, oh, that feels real. And then when his sort of body's adjusting, like, he does have a breakthrough in his teaching life because he is, like, happier. He's more confident in what he's doing. It feels like, you know, he's recapturing something that's gone. And then especially what happens in his personal life of, you know, connecting more with his children, with his wife, and then the revelation that his wife was cheating on him. It's like all very like painful and real. And I think that it's great. This film is great because it has sort of those, you know, complexities to it while also being very fun and funny. And especially the ending, just being exceptionally joyful. I think that I really appreciated that the most about it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, because one of the things that Annika Martin's wife says to him is that it seems like he's lost all his joy. And then, you know, the very last moment in the film is not only him celebrating with all of the high school students who have passed and are graduating and are going to be going to college, which is, you know, obviously a huge like life achievement and goal for some people. And so they're celebrating that in this really lovely euphoric moment. But then also, like, he and Annika appear to be making up and trying to get back on the horse again and try to patch up their relationship based off of, like, text messages that they're sending back and forth to each other. And what I really appreciated about that moment, Evan, is that it follows directly after the funeral, right? So we have this abyssal low where they've just lost one of their good friends and their drinking buddy. And then it goes to this high, right? And it's the juxtaposition in that final moment, that final like 10 minutes of absolutely devastating loss of like losing a friend before their time and the euphoria of celebration. And the thing that I think is most telling about this film and the reason why I enjoyed it so much is that it's not... again, very much unlike the trial of the Chicago Seven, it's not trying to proselytize. It's not trying to preach at you. It's not signed to give a message at all. I wouldn't go that far. It's definitely trying to say something, and people can get different things out of it. But it's not trying to say something about drinking, right? Mm-hmm. Like, which is what I thought it was going to do, right? Because I shared your anxiety as I was initially watching the movie that like, oh, this movie is just going to be about how like drinking is really great and you should drink with your buddies and it'll make life better. And like, as a straight edge person, I'm not like super into that. I like, it's fine. I like, that's cool if that's what people want to do. I'm not judging. It's just like, that's not something that speaks to me. But right. what the film does, right, is it doesn't do that. It says, here are these things that happen when you drink. And sometimes they happen, like really good things happen, really wonderful things happen, and really, really terrible things can happen, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say that you shouldn't drink. It's not like the end of the movie is them all being sober because their friend died, right? And like, oh man, our friend died, so I guess we all should be sober now. No, they celebrate their friend by having a drink together because that's what they did. That's who they are. That's their friends, and that's what they enjoy doing together. And so there's that really tender moment where Tommy's seat is empty and they raise their glasses to Tommy's like seat before going on to the drink. And then they go celebrate with the kids. And so it's like that really beautiful juxtaposition again of the abyssal lows and the super high highs and how drinking and alcohol play into those different moments of despair and heartache and frustration, but also like joy and euphoria and celebration. I don't know. It was really well done and really well paced so that it didn't feel like you were getting bludgeoned over the head with some sort of ideological lesson, but simply like, hey, like this is what happens when people drink. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I really did appreciate that element of the film. A couple aesthetic things I really liked about the film. I liked how the movie portrayed text being written. It was just a black screen with white text being typed onto it. It wasn't like, the iPhone text thing would appear over someone's head, which I think House of Cards, unfortunately, pioneered. I appreciated that. And it is shot very beautifully. It feels like a Terrence Malick film at points.
Oh, 100%, dude.
Yeah. 100%. Like, even like the soccer game with the kids, like, it's a very low camera. And then especially at the end when, you get that incredible dance sequence from
dude,
Mads Mikkelsen.
It's so good.
Like, it's unbelievable. So like, it is so... well choreographed. He's like jumping off of cars and like spinning and everything. I was just like, this is like the greatest thing I have ever seen in my life. And like I was watching the movie, and we don't do like star rankings on the films or anything, but I was like, this feels like a 4-star movie through most of it. And then the ending happened and I was like, that earns a full half star extra. Like, it was just so nice.
Yeah, no, I really, really think that dance number pulled it all together. And like I said, I just aesthetically, especially in music and in film, I love juxtaposition. I love when you take something that's like really, really heavy and juxtapose it with something that's really, really euphoric. Because I think that it shows the full spectrum of the human experience in a really quick amount of time, which I think is incredibly difficult to do. But what it does, what it allows you to do as an audience member is to connect with these different characters in a way that you wouldn't if you just saw the archetypical like narrative structure, right? Where you have the exposition, you have the obstacle that they have to overcome, and then you have the way that they triumph, right? That's a very traditional narrative structure, which is fine and is fun, and it's how heroes are made, right? But I think there's something about the juxtaposition of really like hard, heavy tragedy and euphoric celebration and putting those things right next to each other that does something in the human brain that's like, oh yeah, that's realistic. That's what life is actually like. And this movie builds towards that final moment in such a great way, regardless of whether it's following the subplots of the different kids that these people are interacting with, because each of the different teachers has like a different type of relationship with a different kid, right? Tommy has a relationship with Specs because he's trying to get Specs to like recognize that he can actually play soccer, right? Mads Mikkelsen's character has relationships with pretty much everyone in his class. Like, there's several different characters who he has good conversations with. The psychology professor gives the drink to the one kid and tells him, hey, like, just don't be so anxious. Like you know this stuff. You can talk about Soren Kierkegaard. You'll be fine, right? Like, there's all these like really tender moments between them, and there's both the subplot where they're teachers and the subplot where they're drinking buddies doing this weird, stupid, fun paper together about drinking and maintaining their BAC. That flow together into those two different moments, right? The euphoria of them all graduating and the tragedy of Tommy. And the if viewers can't see this, but it's like this twin structure where they're like winding back and forth and overlapping on top of each other until they get to that final moment where there's the heaviness and the joy. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like, structurally, that's kind of how this film operates. And I think that it's one of the reasons why it's such an impactful and emotionally like satisfying film, because even like, although it does end on a joyful note, I still felt melancholic because it's like still like that the death of Tommy still weighs on you even after you've finished the film and gotten to that higher moment in the very final moments of the motion picture.
I think that's really well said. And for me, the moments where you sort of have that crossover between the inherent silliness and comedy of what they're doing with the sort of darker, potentially life-destroying side of it. I remember the sequence where Tommy is brought into one of the lockers in the gym, and there's all this alcohol that was hidden in there. And he's, you know, very, you know, adamant talking with this guy saying like, oh, has the principal been told about this? No. Okay. And then there's this like increasing suspicion over where this alcohol is coming from in the school. And then when Tommy shows up to like the meeting late with the principal and he's like stumbling around, it was just so sad. And
I
you know, the poster is, you know, Mads Mikkelsen having a drink, you know, you're kind of anticipating this like fun film, and then it just hits you with like this exceptionally sad stuff. And then when, you know, after he loses his job, and then Mads Mikkelsen is like going over to his house, and then Tommy says, I don't want you coming over here anymore, and he's sort of pushing away a little bit because he doesn't let him drink. That's, you know, one aspect of that. It just, this film has very deeply human characters in, you know, very well-written circumstances. And it, you know, it's got it all. You know, besides for, you know, car chases, this is everything you want in a film. So I think pitting these two films together against each other, which one would you say was your favorite this week, Pearson? Another Round or The Trial of the Chicago 7?
You know, as close to my heart as the actual radical politics of the people on trial during the trial of the Chicago 7 are, I definitely have to say that Another Round was a far superior motion picture. You know, Mads Mikkelsen, his performance, as you have said, not to be the dead horse or sound like a broken record, was just riveting. Like, literally, like, there were moments where I looked away to take notes, obviously, but like, if Mads Mikkelsen was on the screen, it was not during one of those moments, right? Like if he was on screen, I was glued. I was like, oh wait, I'm good. I'll wait a second before I take down my note. Yeah, I think that the cinematography, I think the presentation, the humanization, the structure of the film, it was such a well-made movie, and it really is, like you said, such a shame that we have this sort of American-centric. I mean, and again, like, it's the Academy Awards. It's like made by the people in the U.S., so of course it's gonna be, they're gonna be the people who win. crowd, but like, goddamn, give this guy a fucking Oscar.
Mm-hmm. He was certainly better than the performers in Trial of the Chicago 7. And
that's for sure.
Yeah, of course, my vote this week is for another round. You know, another round of another round.
Another round, I say.
Yeah, I didn't immediately want to watch it again because it is just such a huge ride.
It is
but
heavy. Yeah.
At some point in the future, I definitely want to watch it again. And it's a very interesting contrast because I think there are some hidden gems, some very strong films amongst the nominees of this year's Oscars. But when you're giving six nominations to a movie like Trial of the Chicago 7, which upon my second viewing is just one of the most frustrating and mediocre films
Mediocre is the perfect word for it. Like, it's such a milquetoast, mediocre. It's boring too. Yeah. Like, how could you, dude, bro, how can you take something so titanically cool and awesome as 1968 and make such a spectacularly boring movie out of it? It's so boring. Mm-hmm. There's nothing riveting or interesting about, like, the court drama. There was no moment where I was like, man, this is real. I'm really excited to see how they're going to pull this one off. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just so. And maybe it's because, like, I know the history. Maybe it's because of the fact that, like, I actually know these characters. But, like, there's no tension in the movie either. Like, everyone, like, I feel like you go into this movie knowing how it's going to end, even though, right, Aaron Sorkin seems to want to suggest that, oh, something could get better. Maybe the law will prevail. Maybe it's just a couple of bad actors, like this mean judge. Like, there's that fact at the end where the judge was rated, like, unsatisfactory. Who fucking cares? Who fucking cares if the, like, it's just this individualist. All right, I'm going on a tirade. I'll shut up now.
Your words are well heard. And I think that, I mean, there's so many faults with Trial of the Chicago 7. Like, Aaron Sorkin, his skills as a writer are not present in directorial skills. He is making the most boring choices one could make. I will defend one Aaron Sorkin film that I really enjoyed. I liked his Steve Jobs film that Danny Boyle directed. I thought that that was fairly well written. I thought that Michael Fassbender delivered a good performance of Steve Jobs. It mostly has this, like, you know, complex picture of the figure. Maybe a lot of what I like about it is Danny Boyle. And it's just... This movie's very Netflixy, you know? It's all very smooth.
Super Netflixy.
It's all very smooth. The costumes are never too interesting. I think there's even some CG blood during the, like, protest scenes. Like, one person looked at the camera, and they had this, like, gash on their forehead, and it just, the colors just looked so off. And then I realized, like, oh, they digitally put in, like, blood on this guy afterwards. Because there are characters with, like, makeup, with, like, blood that looks good, but then they were just like, you know, Aaron was like, you know what? I was missing this. We got to put some blood on this guy. We're missing a little something.
There's also, like, a bunch of actors from House of Cards. Speaking of, like, it being a Netflix, like, film, like, there's a bunch of actors from House of Cards, which for me was really distracting because I was like, I remember you being this schmarmy, like, piece of shit in House of Cards, and you're being a schmarmy piece of shit here, so I'm glad you can get typecast, bud. Yeah. Like, good for you.
But yeah, if you're watching one movie this week, that if you're going through your Oscar nominees that you haven't seen, you've got to watch Another Round. I think this film is going to get the Kino seal of approval. I quite enjoyed it this week. Pearson, let's get into Recomradations, fan favorite recurring segment where we talk about the pieces of media, life experiences, or anything else under the sun that we've enjoyed this week that we want to pass along to you, the Kino Lefter audience. Pearson, what do you have for me this week?
So for this week, I've got Disco Elysium. We recently did a episode of it for Coffee with Comrades, which you can check out. It's live now. Really, really fun game. Really nuanced role-playing game that does a lot of interesting stuff with playing with, like, noir and with detective work. Its politics are nuanced, but also very deeply dissatisfying, which is a critique that I have of it. And it has, I think, some really interesting stuff to say about how psychology and existentialism and, like, human finitude can figure into, like, our lived experiences. It's also features a super drunk cop. So if you like Another Round, you might like Disco Elysium.
I need to play Disco Elysium very soon. I have been waiting for the right console to get it on because I don't think I would have a satisfying time playing it on PC. I have a Mac. If it's on PS4, maybe, but I think the Switch version might be my preference. So yeah. My recomradation this week is tough. I've watched a lot of good movies recently, so I'll have to whittle it down a little bit. I'm gonna save a lot of recomradation, so I'm gonna go back to a movie I watched April 1st, whenever you're listening to this. But I watched Carol Reed's The Third Man from 1949 for the first time, and what a phenomenal film. I've been wanting to watch The Third Man for a very long time, and I never had like the right format. I wanted to get it on Blu-ray, but the Criterion Blu-ray of The Third Man was out of print, so it is now on Criterion Channel, and I was finally able to watch it. If you're not familiar with The Third Man, it is about it's set in post-war Vienna, a beautiful city. I love Vienna. And there's this pulp writer who is brought in to help out his friend Harry Lime, to realize upon coming to Vienna that his friend is dead. And then there's a conspiracy about his murder, and he is dedicated to solving it. And things are not as they seem. And Orson Welles is also in it, and it's beautifully shot.
Oh, fuck yeah, dude.
And it's a really gorgeous film. It's exceptionally well written. I think it's hailed as one of the greatest movies ever made, and I just got around to it. So if you haven't seen The Third Man,
no, I haven't. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth your time. So Pearson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast this week. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Love chatting with you. If people have enjoyed the wisdom that you've given them so much on this episode, where can people find more?
Well, honestly, Evan, the pleasure is all mine. I've had a blast. As I've said before, I'm a proud supporter of Kino Lefter on Patreon, and y'all should be too, because the material that Evan has been putting out has been nothing but straight fucking bangers. Love the podcast. I'm glad that we could link up again and chat now that we are both doing the single podcasting life.
Mm-hmm.
However, if folks dug this conversation, on occasion we'll do cultural and media criticism on the podcast that I host called Coffee with Comrades. We also talk with organizers and writers and musicians, all sorts of folks on that podcast. It's an interview style kind of podcast where we have conversations with folks and simulate what it would be like to just hang out in a coffee shop and drink coffee and have cool conversations. So if you fuck with that, check it out. It's Coffee with Comrades. You can find it on Patreon. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. I also recently started co-hosting a podcast called Macabre Media, which is so much fun because it is really fun to just have buddies to sit around with and chat about movies with and not have to like book people to like, you know, like, hey, can you do this thing? I'm sure as a podcaster, Evan, you understand what I'm talking about. Having to like bounce back and forth with trying to find people, but just being like, all right, we're going to record on this day and we're gonna have a conversation. But anyways, my God Media podcast is, it's about horror. So if you like horror, regardless of whether it's in movies, video games, television, comic books, short stories, we talk about all that stuff. We recently wrapped up a kaiju miniseries where we talked about all of the movies in the MonsterVerse. It was a miserable time for me, but my two co-hosts had a blast, especially making fun of me and all my not fun takes. But we're talking about The Witch in 2 weeks. You should definitely check out that episode. It's one of my favorite horror movies of all time. Again, you can find Macabre Media Podcast on Twitter. You can find us on Patreon, and you can check us out wherever you get your podcasts.
Beautiful. And if you've enjoyed this episode, you can join the Discord or the Facebook group, and the links for those are in the episode description. And as Pearson was saying, there's a Patreon for this podcast. A lot of new people have joined because I did a crossover with everyone's favorite engineering disaster podcast. Well, there's your problem. But if you're the, I think the next premium episode after this is going to be, again, the Netflix original superhero film Thunder Force, starring Melissa
Why
McCarthy.
Why would you do that to yourself?
It's fun for me. Is it really fun? I don't know. But I'm looking forward to seeing that. And I will have hopefully already put out a teaser for this, but if you haven't listened to it, then you'll hear about it on this episode. For 9 episodes in the premium feed of this podcast, I am launching a brand new series. I did a James Bond series a few months ago, Gun Barrel, about all the James, or about the Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig James Bond films.
Kicked ass.
Yeah, thank you. People liked it. They were like, what's the next series you're going to do? What's the next series that's getting the Gun Barrel treatment? And I thought long and hard about it. I wanted to pick something that I really liked, much like James Bond, so I could, you know, enjoy things and also be able to easily critique what needs to be critiqued. And I chose what many scholars are calling the most political films ever made. Welcome to Takes from the Forbidden Zone, a 9-part episodic series on Planet of the Apes.
Let's fucking go.
So we're starting in 1968 with the Charlton Heston movie. We're going all the way to 2017 with War for the Planet of the Apes. All the movies, the Tim Burton one, that's going to be in there. The movies with bad makeup, those are going to be in there. The James Franco one, all of this and more will be available to listen to. And I will give a little sneak peek to listeners right now. My good friends at Seriously Wrong are going to be on the first episode talking about the first Planet of the Apes film. So,
oh shit, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to hear that, you can head over to patreon.com/kinolaughter. So Pearson, thank you so much for joining the program today. To the beloved listener of Kinolaughter, there's going to be another Oscar double feature next week, and I think based on the movies that are picked, I think it's going to be another stinker and another potentially good one. So
hell yeah.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Kinolaughter is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. You can find great leftist Canadian podcasts like Big Shiny Takes, 49th Parallel, Le Plancher de Vache, Habiti Please, Alberta Advantage, Tech Won't Save Us, and The Progress Report on the network. To find out more and become a supporter of the network, head over to harbingermedianetwork.com.